This is the category of watches most likely to make the average GPHG juror say, "Holy flirkin' snit, I can't believe I'm holding this thing in my hands."
Okay.
You know, I mean, just these like millions of dollars worth of drop dead beautiful high jewelry watches being passed around on a tray, like so many petty fours after dinner. It's pretty
Jack,
wild.
This is why we pay you the big bucks.
the medium money.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverin, and this is a special bonus episode of Hodinkee Radio. Last week was the GPHD, the Grand Prix d'Horlogerie de Genève, which is the biggest awards in watchmaking, sort of like the Oscars of watchmaking. We did a bonus episode before, kind of previewing our picks for who we thought would take home the big prizes. And now, with the awards in the rearview mirror, we thought it'd be nice to sit down and go over the results, talk about who the big winners were, the watches that maybe missed out, and sort of our top highlights of the night. So without further ado, here are our thoughts on the 2019 GPHG. This bonus episode is brought to you by Ferdinand Berthoud and the Chronomet FB1L, an innovative watch with a celestial twist. For more, visit ferdinandberthoud.ch. All right, team, here we are, back in New York. After Cole, Jack, and I were all in rainy, misty, gray Geneva last week. And John, you got to enjoy lovely New York City.
Yeah, I was chilling here in New York while you guys were doing watch stuff.
Doing watch stuff might be the best description of last week. I mean, Jack and I were there for Grand Prix and FHH business, and Cole was there for Grand Prix and auction business. And
official business.
Official, super official business.
Yep. Serious official business.
Yeah, exactly.
But as Cole and I were talking about at the Grand Prix, it is like the most Swiss watch industry event imaginable. It's about as watchy as things can get. Jack, this is what, your third year on the jury?
It is.
Nice. How was it this year?
You know, first of all, I should say at the outset that, you know, as a juror, I have to respect the confidentiality of the proceedings. So unfortunately, I can't share with you the many horologically and anthropologically fascinating things that happened during the jury deliberations. But
okay. Okay.
The one thing I can say is
that's for your memoir, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, the one thing that I can say is there are always, you know, issues with award ceremony, industry award ceremonies of any kind, whether it's the film industry or the watch industry. But I can definitely say that the folks who are in the room have very, very strong beliefs and opinions. And, you know, the debate over which watch deserves to win in every category, it's really vigorous and occasionally acrimonious.
Yeah.
It never quite gets personal, but it gets close sometimes. And, you know, you have to remember a lot of these folks have, you know, a lot of the jurors have known each other for many, many years. People really do. The great thing about that is people really do feel free to speak their minds. So it's a very, very vigorous and a very genuine debate in just about every category. And that was true year one, and it's true now.
Yeah. I think one thing that's important to note for people, too, is that the jury is not comprised just of journalists like yourself, right? Like, there are also retailers and watchmakers and collectors. So some of the reason it's personal is some of these people have personal relationships to the people competing, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And there are varying perspectives too. So, you know, it's quite fantastic for me because, it's a very educational experience for me to be on the jury simply because I actually get to hear from people with expertise in areas that I don't have. So
yeah.
When we look at the high jewelry watches,
what are those?
Well,
that was a joke.
It's a small slice. No, I mean, well, John, to answer your question, one big area is horological gems and gem setting, which I know probably more about than the average watch guy. But, you know, there are people on the GPHG jury who have spent their lives around precious stones and big, important stones very often. And to be able to ask them, well, listen, okay, here's a beautiful high jewelry piece. I don't really know that much about evaluating stones. You know, how does somebody with your level of experience look at something like this? That's just, it's a great experience.
Yeah. That's a very fair point. Yeah. No, I was just kidding, to be clear.
No. I mean, this isn't, you know, the larger question is how can a grown-up write about watches for their entire professional life? And the answer is it's a narrow subject, but also very deep, and there's always a lot to learn.
Yeah. All right. Cole, it was your first GPHG. Before we get into the prizes, you and I were sitting together in the audience. What would you say was your sort of 10,000-foot view of the event?
Well, I have not been to the Academy Awards, Oscars, any of that, but no? I know the you know, the proceedings, how it goes, and yeah. It reminds me a lot of that. I mean, that's been the nickname or whatever, but
yeah.
I was just blown away by how, to get back to the point, how seriously it's taken and how passionate. I mean, it's an element of national pride from the Swiss side, and then a lot of people hang their entire reputations on this industry and their place in it and so forth, so it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's serious business.
It's a huge deal. So yeah, that was my takeaway.
All right. With that in mind, let's get into it. We're going to go through these prizes. We're going to move relatively briskly just because we don't want this to be a 6-hour long bonus episode. But I figure we'll announce what won, and then we can each kind of voice some thoughts. We're going to go in the order that they're listed on the Grand Prix site, which is relatively close to the order in which they're announced at the Grand Prix. There's a couple out of order, but let's start off with the ladies' watch prize. That went to the Chanel J12 caliber 12.1, which is a sort of reimagining of the J12 on its 20th anniversary. What do we think about that?
Well, I remember when we were talking in the previous show, when we were kind of, it was a different crew of us here, but we were Steven and me, and then I think Ben and Cara. This was a popular one. I did not pick it, but I can see definitely why it won. This is, in my opinion, you know, about as classic as it gets for a ladies' watch, and it has a brand new movement, made in house,
yeah.
With lots of lots of improvements over what was previously used. So this is it makes sense as a, you know, you think of the ladies and men's watch prizes as, well, at least I think of them as watch, you know, prizes that should be given to watches that can be worn every day, and this is definitely that.
Yeah. I would agree.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I pretty much would just echo everything John has said. Great classic new iteration of a great classic design. It's an absolute icon in modern watchmaking for ladies' watches, and it's definitely durable and versatile enough to be an everyday watch. And, you know, I agree with John also in that these categories, men's and ladies' watches, they should represent to some degree watches that you'd be comfortable wearing on a daily basis. And, you know, it's a rockin' daily wear.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Also in the ladies watch arena, let's go to the ladies complication watch prize. This one went to the MB&F Legacy Machine Flying T. And I'm just going to stay right off the bat. This was the prize I was maybe most excited from the whole night, to go to this watch. Like I was, when they announced this, I was so happy for Max Bucer and his team. This watch is unbelievable. Really something special. And you could tell both from his acceptance speech and just, you know, I had a chat with Max afterwards. This really meant something and more than an award at the Grand Prix would normally mean to him. And like, it really just couldn't happen to better people.
Yeah. I mean, it was for me, definitely the most emotional GPHG I've ever been to. And this particular watch, you know, I think Max's speech was great. It really came from the heart. The watch really came from the heart. The ladies complication category was a very tough one for me because there were some very, very strong watches there. Some really, really interesting competition. I mean, I loved Max's watch just because seeing him take his sensibility and use it to produce such a successful design in a ladies timepiece was pretty fantastic. Nothing against any of the other pieces, by the way.
Yeah, I picked this watch back during the Baselworld roundups. So I was blown away by it, seeing in person. And yeah, it definitely went to the right place. And Max never speaks without emotion, right? So yeah, it was great. It was really nice to see that. Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool watch.
Yeah.
The prize couldn't have gone to a nicer guy. Congrats to Max.
Awesome. All right. Next up, the men's watch. This went to the Voutilainen 28 Ti. Which I have to say, I thought was kind of a dark horse in this category. It's an awesome watch. I'm a known huge fan of Voutilainen, but you know, going up against the Groeneveld, going up against the Laurent Ferrier, going up against the Grand Seiko, this to me didn't scream like amazing everyday wearer, but I don't know. It's a compelling piece, and he got quite the cheer from the audience.
Many times.
That's true.
Which we'll get to.
Yeah. Kari. Yeah. Spoiler alert. Kari wins again later. But yeah, I mean, Jack, I know you can't talk too much about the kind of like deliberations of the jury, but can you tell us at all? Was this category like tight? Was this a tightly contested one?
I mean, I can say in general, pretty much I felt as a juror, like all of the categories were pretty tightly contested this year.
Okay.
There were a lot of strong, I don't know, maybe it's just, 3 years of experience doing this, but I felt like there was a much closer competition within each category this year than I was used to seeing in the previous 2 years. And, you know, like the ladies categories, this was a very tough call for a lot of jurors.
Yeah.
Taking nothing away from Kari and his achievement, I think I, like Steven, expected this probably to go to either the Grunfeld or the Grand Seiko. Laurent Ferrier had kind of a different design than we're used to seeing from Laurent Ferrier, and I remember it being somewhat polarizing when that watch came out in January. I expected it to go to the Grunfeld, but you know, congrats to Kari. He also made a very nice watch.
Yeah. All right, up next we've got the men's complication prize, kind of echoing the women's categories. And this one went to the Audemars Piguet Code 1159 Minute Repeater Super Sonnery. I'm going to throw to the gang here to get your takes before I weigh in here. Anyone have strong thoughts about this one?
I thought the during the acceptance speech, there were some like subtle jabs at all the naysayers and everything. It was finally like...
Yeah, Francois didn't pull any punches.
Yeah. So I thought that was the most interesting thing about it.
Okay.
It's funny.
Yeah, I mean, I think Francois made an interesting point, which is it's been a rough year, you know, for Audemars Piguet because the... launch of Code 1159 got off to a rough start. That's not news to anybody, certainly in this room, and it's certainly not news to anybody who's been following watchmaking. I will say the Super Sonnery, this is one, you know, judged as a complication, minute repeaters are tough because you have to hear them. And I am very, very, very lucky in that I've had a chance to hear dozens of different minute repeaters from the people who are the best in the world at making them. And historically, this is something Audemars Piguet has done exceptionally well. You know, nowadays, you know, you think AP and you haven't been around watch as much, it's Royal Oak, Royal Oak, Royal Oak. But they've made some of the most amazing sounding minute, you know, repeating wristwatches, Grand Sonneries, pocket watches in the entire history of watchmaking. And when you have this thing, you know, when you have the Super Sonnery 1159 in your hand and you hear it do its thing, I mean, the hair stood up on the back of my head.
Yeah. I have not listened to quite as many repeaters as Jack, but
yes,
this thing
have.
Is no, not even close. But this thing's amazing. And you know, we've seen this repeater in a couple different executions over the last few years, starting
right.
with the RD1 and then building up. And say what you will about Code 1159, like this is a hell of a watch.
It is a hell of a watch, but did you guys notice that AP also this year, or perhaps late last year, it's not totally clear, dropped a conventional Royal Oak version of the Super Sonnery?
Yeah, so I did. And the way I found out that watch existed was when I was in Tokyo a few weeks ago, saw it in the boutique. They had one in the Ginza boutique.
Gosh.
And I was like, what is this? And they were like, oh yeah, it's a Royal Oak Sonnery. Yeah. And I was like, excuse me?
It like just appeared on the AP website last week.
It's
as
crazy.
As far as we know.
Yeah. It's I would not be surprised if we see that watch entered next year personally.
I mean, one thing I would love to do is hear the different versions of the Super Sonnery technology that have come out kind of, you know, against each other. I'm curious how much, you know, case shape and case manufacturing have a huge effect on how a repeating watch sounds.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'd love to hear the AP next to the 1159.
Reference points, Super Sonneries.
Oh my God. That would be, you know, that we shouldn't give anything away, but that would be a fun story to put together, get them all together.
We're blowing up our own spot here. All right, so for the next category, we've got the Iconic Watch Prize. And once again, this is AP's second win of the night. Was for the Audemars Piguet Royal Oak Jumbo Extra Thin. This is the one that's in white gold with that sort of salmon-colored dial. I think we knew pretty well going into this category. This was one of the ones I think was a very safe bet. I don't think you would have gotten very good odds placing bets on this one.
Yeah, there were some icons in there, but
yeah, there were some great watches. I mean, that's not to say anything bad about the Monaco or the El Primero or
even the old Hammy.
Yeah, I mean the Intermatic's a great watch, but yeah. I think when you think about like iconic watches, like it's tough to argue with a Royal Oak like that.
Yeah, you know, the question for me came down to, you know, I look at these watches, they're six great watches, they're six, in some respects, very different watches. So then the question becomes, all right, I'm supposed to pick the one that's the most iconic, which one is the most iconic?
The other thing too, the A384 revival appeared as opposed to the A386, which I think the A386 is much more of an icon.
Yeah, you're right. And even the Monaco, that's not like the most iconic looking Monaco that one thing right. chosen.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think Ben brought that up right yeah. on the preview episode that the A384 felt like a weird choice here, but there you have it.
Yeah.
You know. Next up, we've got the chronometry prize. We're starting to get into some of the more technical categories here. And this one went to Ferdinand Berthoud for the carburized steel regulator.
Chronometry, Ferdinand Berthoud. Yeah, the challenge for me with the chronometry category is, okay, chronometry is about, it's two things nowadays. On the one hand, it's aspirational in that brands try to come up with technical solutions that are chronometrically oriented and that are also fun to look at and fun to talk about. So, you know, multiple turbines linked with differentials, exotic material for balance springs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The IWC, for instance, has a Remontoir on the tourbillon, which is, you know, it's an amazing achievement technically yeah. and quite rare. So there's all of that. But then, you know, the chronometry is also, it's not just about the technical flourishes. You know, I mean, the way that you find out whether or not a car lives up to its reputation is you take it out on the track and you see how it performs. And absent comparative chronometric data, it's yeah. hard to evaluate in an absolute sense watches in a chronometry category.
Yeah, it is tough. Yeah, it's interesting to me that, I mean, the FB is not the most, I guess, technically complex watch in this category. It's among them for sure. But I think it's clear that this is a watch oriented around the idea of chronometry, sort of to steal a phrasing from you, Jack, like, it's oriented around chronometry for its own sake. Like that is the raison d'etre of this watch yeah. in a way that I think some of the other watches in this category, you could argue have other things, right? Like the Prezuzo is also a gem set watch with a bunch of tourbillons that's meant to be sort of visually appealing. The Armenstrom has this idea of resonance attached to it. The Zenith Defy is about this all new regulating organ. The IWC is still at the end of the day. It's a big pilot. It's a complicated big pilot, but it's a big pilot. And the Tag is really about this sort of one innovation, the Isograph balance spring. But there's something about the Berthoud that really makes sense here. And, you know, for full disclosure, you will hear on this episode, Ferdinand Berthoud is our sponsor this week. But that obviously had no impact on the results, the
information that they're sponsoring this episode traveled backwards in time, and affected the jury selection.
Yes.
Yeah. It's one of the things the watch does. It causes these weird little eddies in the space.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Continue.
That's why it won. Yeah.
That's how good it is.
Yeah, I have a question for you, Jack, here.
Sure. I'll answer it if I can.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you can or not, but when you analyze these watches, do you have all of the chronometry data on hand? Because to me, it's a pretty simple. The most yeah. accurate watch would win this award.
Yeah, it's tough because the way to do it would be to have to really do it right. You would have to have an independent third party testing agency do classic 30-day
right.
observatory. Rate the watches in positions. You know, see how the how balance, amplitude, and positional variations shake out over the entire power reserve of the watch. It's one. I remember many, many years ago sitting next to Stephen Forzi at a dinner. I think it was 2006, maybe earlier, when they first launched Grubel Forzi in New York. He gave me a fascinating look into the rationale for what they were trying to do with their tourbillons, with their multi-axis tourbillons in terms of accuracy. And I said to him, yeah, does it really offer a significant advantage over, just a really well-made lever escapement watch? And he looked at me and laughed and said, it's always a struggle to gain more than you lose. So with additional complexity, obviously comes the possibility for additional factors that may upset the rate stability of the watch.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, you look at watches that won chronometry competitions in the past. There were some tourbillons that scored extremely well, but by and large, you know, these were not watches that had a lot of additional bells and whistles designed to make them more accurate. They were simply constructed, very precisely made watches that were adjusted within an inch of their life by people who were at the top of their game, specifically for the observatory, you know, competition trials. But they weren't generally complicated watches.
Right. Yeah.
Like thermocompensated balance wheels and things like that, but not tourbillon mechanisms.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, there are exceptions. I mean, you know, there are observatory tourbillons that you know, scored very, very high in their respective categories. Number one on, you know, for a number of years, Patek Philippe observatory tourbillons did very well, for instance, you know, pocket watches. But yeah, so long story short, I think chronometry is tough because there are things that you can do that are illustrative of the pursuit of chronometry and that refer, you know, back to the various ways in which it's been pursued. But, you know, with chronometry, it's like you got to put your money where your mouth is.
All right, so up next, we've got another complicated category. This is the calendar and astronomy category. It's kind of a similar field, actually, to some of the previous ones. And the winner was Hermès with the Arceaux
de la Lune.
There we go, Jack. There we go. As I'm stumbling over, and I'm getting mealy-mouthed here, and you're stepping in and saving me.
You see, after a week in Geneva, the accent.
I personally love this watch. I'm super happy to see this win. Yeah, I got nothing more than that, but this is a killer watch. I've loved this since I saw it at SIHH, and I think it'd be tempting with the calendar and astronomy category to go for something super like technical and kind of nerdy. And instead I like the idea that like this is something really poetic. Like you can show this watch to somebody who knows nothing and they're gonna be like, oh my God, what is that?
Yeah, you know, to me, the cool thing about this category is six great watches, all of which had very, very different value offerings. You know, and I mean, I know I keep saying it, but it was tight. I know the Hermès Arceaux L'Heure de la Lune has a lot of fans here at Hodinkee, and I think that there's certainly a reason for that. You know, what was cool for me to see in person was the Sarpaneva, and they used fiber optics for the for the moon phase on that one.
Yeah.
And I actually took the watch into a dark corner of the room and shone a UV torch on it. And you know, the illusion that you're looking at an actual full moon kind of like through a slightly misty sky, it's very, very vivid. I mean,
it's cool.
But you know, this again is one of the great things about being on the jury. You get to see watches you might not otherwise have seen. And I thought it was pretty nifty.
I won't call him or her out by name. But one of your fellow jurors and I had a conversation after the awards at the little dinner, reception afterwards. And they said that they think this is the coolest watch that didn't win anything, the Sarpaneva. And I'm tempted to agree with them that like, this is quietly like one of the coolest watches in the competition. And it's kind of a shame that it didn't find a way to take home a prize because Stepan really did an awesome job here.
I agree. And, you know, again, this speaks to the real diversity of opinions among the jurors, too, and the real strength of feeling people have about the choices they made.
This bonus episode is brought to you by Ferdinand Berthoud. The modern Ferdinand Berthoud brand launched in 2013 with the goal of making complex watches focused on precise chronometry, much like its namesake, an 18th century master of the marine chronometer. The brand's first watch, the FB1, took home the prestigious grand prize at the 2016 Grand Prix d'Horlogerie de Genève, and just last week, they won yet again, this time being awarded the chronometry prize for the carburized steel regulator. Carrying through much of the FB1's DNA is the new FB1L, a watch that shows the time as well as the phase and age of the moon, inspired by scientific exploration and the spirit of the Enlightenment. The FB1L has Ferdinand Berthoud's signature 44mm octagonal case design with a round, spacious dial at the center. The hours and minutes are displayed at 12 o'clock, with a large central seconds hand emphasizing the watch's focus on precision. New, though, are the age of the moon and the phase of the moon displays, both of which reside in the bottom half of the dial. These displays deviate just one day every 577 years, making them some of the more accurate astronomical complications on the market today. All of this is powered by the caliber FB-TFCL, an in-house movement that is both technically brilliant and beautifully finished. The power barrel and constant force Fusain chain mechanism are both open so you can see them functioning, and the 1 minute tourbillon has an impossibly delicate looking cage that seems to float down at 6 o'clock. It's a true tour de force of modern watchmaking. Only 20 of these watches will be made in total. 10 with a combination white gold and black ceramic case, and 10 with a combination ceramized titanium and white gold case. This is a truly unique watch built for collectors who crave something special. For more on Ferdinand Berthoud and the Chronomet FB1L, visit ferdinandberthoud.ch. All right, let's get back to the show. Mechanical exception. This is like the most complicated category. And the watch that won is the Genus GNS 1.2. Which is this sort of independent brand founded by this sort of like small collective of watchmakers in Geneva. It's a cool thing. One thing worth noting here, and not to take away from their win at all. I always personally love it when the little guys win. And this clearly was like monumental for them. The two people who accepted this were basically in tears. It was really awesome to see.
Yeah, it's an emotional night.
One thing to note, though, is that, and this is a bit of a spoiler, three of the other watches in this category won other awards, which then disqualifies them from being able to win their own category because you can't double up. So one thing to note is that, we don't know what order the voting came in, but it is worth noting that of the six watches in this category, it produced four winners, which I think speaks maybe to the sort of like preferences of the jury that complicated watchmaking is something that sort of spoke to the jury this year. And I won't even make you weigh in on that, Jack. I'll let you maintain your...
Yeah, I'm going to recuse myself from this one.
So up next, we have the chronograph category, which I know a lot of us, everyone's nodding now, like smiling and nodding, which is a good sign. The watch that won here was the Bulgari Octofinissimo Chronograph GMT Automatic. And I have to say, when this watch was announced, because the big prize, the Aiguille d'Or, the sort of like big prize, is a watch from a category. It doesn't have its own category. And if a watch wins its category, you know that it's not winning the grand prize. And heading in, there was lots of chatter that this watch from Bulgari might take home the big kahuna that night. And when it was announced, there was simultaneously like a cheer for it winning and also sort of like for it having won because it meant it didn't win the big prize. But yeah, this Bulgari, to me, this was hands down the best chronograph of the year.
I don't think I'm giving anything away about the jury deliberations to say that I think that there was no surprise here.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if we'll never know if a watch wins unanimously, but like I would not at all be surprised if this watch won this category unanimously.
If I were sitting in the if I had been sitting in the audience, I would have been surprised to see another watch win.
Yeah, I think there would have been gasps and howling and wailing if somebody else had won this category.
I would have literally got up and left.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding.
Okay. You would have had to have gotten past me, which would have been an issue. But yeah, I think it's a testament to the strength of this watch that we're all just like, yeah, duh. Like it's the chronograph category, which is one of the most contested categories every year. And this year it was like, we knew, like there was no question. Sticking with sport watches, we then have the divers category. And the divers category went to the Seiko Prospects LX Line Divers. Cole, you were pretty happy when this one was announced.
Super, super stoked.
Cole was cheering.
Yeah, I was.
Clapping. Yeah.
As a lifelong Seiko, well, I won't say lifelong because that implies my entire life, but as a watch lifelong Seiko guy, I was super, super stoked. It kind of reminded me of a few years ago. You remember when Japanese whiskey dethroned Scotch whiskey at its own game, right?
Yeah.
So this is a Seiko coming into a Swiss competition and winning.
And you can tell there's some like ill will. It wasn't as bad this year as it was a couple years ago when a Grand Seiko won, I can't remember what prize, but the Grand Seiko GMT High Beat won one of the big prizes a couple years ago. And like, you can tell it makes the Swiss industry a little bit uncomfortable to watch the Japanese win.
But I mean, they're like Mr. Naito said in his speech, Japan is an island faring nation, or seafaring nation, island nation. It just makes sense. Seiko makes a great dive watch.
Yeah.
So here's the interesting thing to me about this category, and this reflects one of the huge challenges that the jury has. So you look at the six watches in this category, and you've got, three watches that are arguably hardcore dive watches that look as if they were specifically designed for diving. The Ulysses Nardin is a little bit, on the fence in that respect. It feels a little bit more design forward than the Longines. But then you look at the other ones, and these are watches with completely different intentions from a design standpoint than the Seiko. So, and the Resonance is a cool watch. The Reservoir is a cool watch. The De Bethune is a cool watch. But it's a huge, huge challenge to evaluate six such different watches at such different price points with such different, clearly such different intentions and agendas. It makes it very, very difficult. Like the De Bethune, for instance, like that's a super, super cool watch. But if you're trying to decide between that and the Seiko in the divers category, man, you got your work cut out for you.
Or do you though? I mean, all right, we're going diving tomorrow, Jack. Right. Which watch do you take?
I mean, who are we diving with? What boat? How big is the boat we're diving off of?
All right. To keep things moving, I'm gonna have to quash this beef, but we'll have to bring you guys back to do a Battle of the Dive Watches show. Up next is jewelry, which Jack referred to earlier. And here we've got the second win for Bulgari. We've got the Bulgari Serpenti Misteriosi Romani. I'll be totally blunt. I don't know shit about jewelry. I know nothing about jewelry, but I've seen this in person. I've seen two or three different variations on this in person. It's mind blowing. Like this is a thing where like you don't need to know anything about jewelry to understand on the face of it why this is interesting. But I would assume that if you do, you find it even more compelling.
This is the category of watches most likely to make the average GPHG juror say, holy flirkin snit, I can't believe I'm holding this thing in my hands.
Okay.
Just these like millions of dollars worth of drop dead beautiful high jewelry watches being passed around on a tray. Like so many petty fours after dinner. It's pretty
this
wild.
Is why we pay you the big bucks.
the medium money.
And what is the value of something like this?
The retail for the Bulgari is 2.7 million Swiss, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay.
It has right. A blue sapphire like the size of my fist sitting on top of the head of the snake.
It's an amazing stone. Yeah. I think it's 10 plus carats, and it's such an incredible
pave set bangle. I mean, how many diamonds are there on this? It's got to be.
There are all the diamonds.
Yeah, it's hundreds of diamonds on this thing. It's wild.
It is. I believe it's the most expensive high jewelry watch that Bulgari has ever created in its entire history, which if you're Bulgari is saying something.
Yeah. Sticking with sort of the more artistic side of things, we've got the artistic crafts watches, which is another category where like I am certainly not an expert. And this was another duplicative award. This one also went to Voutilainen for the Starry Night Vine. Which was a custom piece created for a client. So this is a unique one-off watch. It's Kari, but it's also handwork on the dial. It's multiple enameling techniques. It's pretty bonkers stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a phenomenal piece to look at. The level of attention to detail is certainly there, but the artistry of the execution is it just cannot be gainsaid. You look at this thing and you really are looking at something that would be you could display it in a museum next to any collection of absolutely exceptional enamel pieces that you could possibly imagine, and it would not suffer by comparison.
Nice. Next up we've got the Petite Aiguille, which is for watches under what, Jack, under 10,000 Swiss francs?
I'd have to look.
I believe it's under 10,000 Swiss francs.
Yeah. You'd think that as a juror, I would have this kind of thing committed to memory.
Nah,
but,
that's fine. That's not why you're there, Jack.
Yeah, I mean, the number of things I can commit to memory goes down every year. So, I think under 10.
So for this one, we got another small independent winner with the Kudoke 2. This is a watch I've never seen in the metal. I have basically no experience, but... it's a husband and wife duo who decided to launch a watch brand in Germany, and it looks from all the photos I've seen like a pretty beautiful piece. And again, it's nice to see the little guys taking on the likes of the big boys.
Yeah, they're also friends with the Habrings, I believe. They publicly acknowledged them in their thank you speech for encouraging them to pursue their dream and not dilute their vision.
Yeah, Cole, you seemed pretty excited when these guys won.
Yeah, well. All right, full disclosure, I have never even heard of kudoke. To me, it sounds like a Japanese word or something like that, yeah. Right? And then saw the watch, I was like, oh, wow, all right. And then, yeah, the emotion, the cadence of their speech, they pause, they recognize people. They said the Habrings got them into watchmaking. And again, just another example of two people with an idea, a vision, and we'll get to one later, I think.
Yeah,
that was really emotional. But yeah, I really liked that. It was very cool to see that.
Awesome. John, you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always nice to see the little guy win. I did not think that was going to happen here. I think, you know, for value for money, the IWC seemed like with the bronze case, seemed like a really strong contender in this category. And so I was really shocked, actually, when the results came in.
Yeah.
How did your shock manifest itself? Did you gasp audibly?
I gasped audibly.
Did you need to go to the bar cart for...
I think one of the cool things about this category, though, is like, you know, a number of us have never seen this watch or in Cole's case, heard of this brand. And like, that's where this award can be meaningful, right? Is like, if IWC or Zenith produces another high value, high quality watch, like none of us are surprised. Whereas this now makes me want to go take a look at this brand. Like,
right.
This is going to change things, hopefully, for them and get them in front of a whole new audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. Yeah.
So the last of the standard categories is the challenge prize, which is even lower priced. I believe this is under 5,000 or 6,000Swiss francs. And the winner of this category, which Cole alluded to, And the winner of this category was one of the big guys. It was Tudor for the Black Bay P01, which I know Cole is a huge fan of. This was another one that got quite an applause and a holler from Cole.
Yeah. Now Cole has been he was an early advocate of this one, which produced some pushback among the Tudor faithful. But you kind of liked it right from Jump Street.
Yeah, I still do. I mean, I think actually the general opinion, who knows? I mean, who knows? We kind of have our finger on the pulse, sure. But I think the general opinion is people are accepting this watch more and more.
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting to see at least some sectors of the online community start to come around to your way of thinking. And I think it speaks to how something we're not used to from a given brand can sometimes struggle to reach an audience, you know, in early days. And we tend to make decisions about things very quickly. And I think that's natural. I mean, the truth is, you know, nowadays you're bombarded left and right by so much information. You kind of have to do triage on what you like and don't like very, very quickly. But you know, again, it's nice to see that there's an opportunity for a more considered perspective once the initial dust settles.
I agree.
Yeah. When you think about it, most watches are designed to be sold, right? Designed to be sold, crowd pleasers. This one was not at all.
Yeah, they're designed to be sold and they're designed to, like you said, please the crowd immediately, right? Because in a sea of watches all competing for our attention, I think it's that initial reaction that that the designers are looking for. But this is a watch that has proven to be successful, at least by one measure, winning this award over time. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So now we're going to get into the special prizes, which, you know, Jack, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the way this works is these prizes are chosen from the whole pool. So these can be from any category. There's a handful of them, including we're going to get to the big guy. First up, we have the innovation prize, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's for a watch that has an innovative complication or does something that's never been done before. Mm-hmm. And for that, we have the Vacheron Constantin Traditionnel Twin Beat Perpetual Calendar.
Which, you know, it's pretty damn innovative.
It's pretty damn innovative. And
that right there is an innovation.
Yeah. And it was fun. Vacheron brought with them. Apparently, the story here is this complication started out as a side project from two watchmakers who work in their complications department, who kind of like had sketched it in their free time. And they showed up at work one day and said, like, hey, can we talk to somebody? And they showed this, and apparently the department in charge of budgets said, like, oh, God, no. oh, please, please don't do this to us. And instead, Vacheron made the investment and let these guys kind of run wild with this thing and develop something really special.
And, you know, this is one of the things I do love about Vacheron. I mean, they're a super, super traditional company, and you know, you look at their advertising, you look at their marketing messages, it's really, really strong on traditional watchmaking values. But they do spend money on technical innovation that they probably don't need to in order for their, you know, in order for what they do to be a business. And it's just nice to see.
Yeah, I agree. It's nice to see that get rewarded too. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Especially that's one where I'm glad this prize went to one of the big guys. Is I think it's nice to encourage the big brands, the people who might have a little bit of budget, the people who have bigger teams of watchmakers who can attract some of the top talent, to encourage them to keep pushing it and not to kind of like rest on their laurels. And I think this is what Vacheron did. Vacheron, you know, took a risk and really decided to kind of like shoot for the stars here. And it's nice to see them get the recognition.
Hmm. Yeah, it's good to see a brand like Vacheron kind of like, I would say, like you guys said, pushing it. And then hopefully, you know, things will come out of watches, developments that will eventually trickle down into more, you know, wearable, scalable types of watches.
Trickle down Watchonomics.
Yeah.
Something like that.
All right. So things that won't trickle down. We've got the watch that won the Audacity Prize, which is, again, exactly what it sounds like. And that went to the Urwerk AMC, which, Jack, this is the prize you announced, right?
Yes.
This watch is bananas. It's absolutely nuts.
I mean, it's pretty damned audacious.
Yeah.
That there's an audacious watch.
Ben was really hot on it when we, were talking in our sort of preview episode. And I think rightfully so. Essentially it's a Sympatique, right? Like it's the watch, the mechanical watch docks into an atomic clock and then sets the watch to match the atomic clock.
It's so audacious, but it also references something that's existed for hundreds of years, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Albeit in a completely modern way.
So the couple of interesting things technically about this particular piece, number one, like the Breguet Sympatique, all the connections between the master clock and the watch are purely mechanical, so there are no electronic linkages. So you place the watch in the cradle, and the watch is regulated, wound, and set through purely mechanical interactions, which is pretty amazing. That alone is pretty incredible. The second thing is the atomic clock is actually a bespoke atomic clock. So you can buy off the shelf atomic clocks, but this one they designed from the ground up, well, with the help of a physicist team that was I think pretty exhausted by the whole process. I mean, really from the ground up, like they looked through their available options in terms of which ions they would use resonators in the atomic clock, you know, kind of started from there and just built the whole thing up from scratch. So I don't think anybody's ever done a bespoke atomic clock before.
All right.
Although I guess in a sense, the early ones were all bespoke, but it's still pretty incredible technical achievement.
Also not at all connected to the watchmaking, but Felix Baumgartner got up on stage in a suit and some high top Jordans to accept this award, which strong move, Felix.
Yeah.
I applaud that. Yeah. All right, we've got one more before the big prize. We've got the Horological Revelation Prize. This one's a little more confusing. Jack, can you kind of explain to us what the jury's thought process is when they're picking a watch here before we reveal the winner?
Yeah, so revelation in a kind of, in for an English speaker, somewhat archaic sense here, in the sense of something that is new, you know, sort of new on the scene and kind of an unexpected and pleasant surprise.
Cool. And I think that it is very fitting that this prize went to Ming for the 17.06 copper. It was awesome to watch those guys win. We know those guys pretty well. Future Hodinkee Radio guests. It was like watching a bunch of like collectors and friends who you know from like your local watch meetup get to go up and accept an award there. And it was like, it was so much fun. And they were so happy to be up there on stage.
I have to say, I have known, okay, so, you know, full disclosure, I know Ming for close to 20 years. When I first met him, he was 16 years old and he was posting, watch movements that he had designed in his spare time on thepurists.com. And I mean, crazy, crazy, crazy over the top stuff, much more Baroque and much more complex than the watches he makes now. But a lot of the basic aesthetics were already there, which is interesting to see.
Yeah.
I just can't believe I've known the guy for 20 years.
20 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
Cole and I got to circle up with him and his team, afterwards, cause he had his team with him. He was one of the few people, who took more than like one person up on stage with him. And it wasn't like him and a business partner. It was like four guys up on stage. It would have been
a
five,
posse.
But
it was, a proper posse.
It was cool. It was nice. Again, like if we're talking about the Oscar vibes, it was really a team thing. And he thanked the community. And, you know, I think of all the cases of like the good guys winning, this might be the most kind of like poignant example of the good guys winning.
I had a glass of champagne with him after the, at the after party. And I said to him, Ming, come on, you know, like 20 years ago, you were 16. I was just this like grubby guy on thepurist.com, and here we are. You won a prize, and I'm on the jury. Peace in our time.
You guys did well for yourself.
Yeah, you guys made good. All right, last up, the big prize, kahuna. The big kahuna.
Oh wait. We should probably mention the special jury prize though. Just
okay. Okay. It's not a watch. Oh, it's not a watch. That. Jack, do you wanna talk us through that?
So not a watchmaker, but probably the only person in the entire watch industry who could get so many different brands, many of whom are bitter competitors, all in the same place for the same purpose. Mr. Luke Petavino, who was the founder of Only Watch. Only Watch, as everybody knows, exists to raise funds to try to find a cure for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which is a degenerative and irreversible disorder of skeletal muscle in the body. It produces progressive weakening. And his son, who passed away not long ago, was diagnosed with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which is the impetus for Luke to start the Only Watch auction. And I have to say, I cannot, and I think that the consensus at the GPHG during the award ceremony as well was absolute. There's nobody that we can think of who deserved the prize more.
Yeah.
What a year for him to win too.
Yeah,
given
of course.
What happened over at Only Watch with Patek, you know.
True.
Yeah. Yeah. And the only guy to have a standing ovation. No watch got a standing ovation.
No.
You go and look at the results from Only Watch. I mean, and they're 100% donated to a medical research. He raises a colossal sum of money that goes in a very, very worthwhile direction.
Something like 38 million Swiss francs or something like that they raised this time, which is just a ton of money, you know.
That's wild.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool to watch. Obviously pretty emotional, and I got to say Arel Box gives a hell of an introductory speech.
He really did it
for Jean-Claude Beaver last year, and then this one. That guy can give a speech.
He's good in front of a crowd.
He is hella good in
That's
front of a crowd.
That's why they pay him the big bucks.
I mean, listen, Arel is Arel for a reason.
It's true. All right, last thing. The big kahuna. Jack, how do we pronounce this?
Aiguille d'or.
There we go.
Grand Prix.
The big prize. This is essentially the Watch of the Year award. And it went to Audemars Piguet for the Royal Oak Self-Winding Perpetual Calendar Ultra Thin, which people might know as the RD2, is what it was called before its final version. This is a watch that by this point in the ceremony, I think everyone in the room knew this was the winner. It had not been awarded anything yet. And I think the vibe was in the room. It was the third prize for Audemars Piguet. You could tell Francois, the CEO, was really loving getting to keep going up up to the dais as it was well earned. It's cool. I mean, you know, Giulio Poppi from APRP was acknowledged during this win. Got to talk to him after the ceremony, and like, he's like the most humble guy in the entire watchmaking industry, despite being a total genius. This watch is just awesome. Like, it's complicated. It's innovative. It's cool. It's a watch that, like, if you don't know anything about watchmaking, you can still enjoy. Like, I don't know. For me, this seems right. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was maybe Steven who alluded to in the last podcast about GPHD. This is a watch that combines the cool factor, or I guess the popular cool factor of AP with, like, you know, the watchmaking chops that those of us who like kind of live and breathe watchmaking absolutely know that they have in spades. I mean, this is, like you said, a watch that you don't really need to know anything about watchmaking to know that that's one damn cool watch.
Yeah. You know, we had a couple of record setters, for flatness this year. We had, the Bulgari and we had the AP, and, just both really, really incredible watches. And, you know, I mean, I wrote about the Royal Oak Self-Winding Perpetual Calendar Ultra Thin for the site, and a lot of those numbers were still fresh in my head for the jury deliberations. And, I don't think that I'm violating any confidentiality to say that I think this is an extraordinary watch. From a technical standpoint, it's really traditional watchmaking. I mean, there's none of the decisions that Giulio Poppi made in terms of figuring out how to get a perpetual calendar and a calendar into a movement this flat would have been hard to understand for a watchmaker from 100 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's real high-end, center-of-the-road, bullseye, sophisticated Swiss haute horlogerie. classic Swiss Eau de Logerie, and it's kind of a statement of what the industry should aspire to. I think it's a fantastic watch.
I think that's a hell of a summary, sir.
Yeah, well,
I don't have anything else to add. That's it. I'm out.
Did you write about this watch, Jack?
And I think, you know, it's worth mentioning that in a year with certainly ups and downs for AP, this was a nice way to kind of bring the year to an end, I think.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And congrats to Francois and to Julio and to the whole team over there. It's a heck of a thing. Heck of a thing to win the award. And, you know, the field this year was strong. I mean, I really think looking at the competitors this year, there were some strong watches, and most categories had enough pieces in it that I think it was pretty, I know you can't say anything, Jack, but I think it was probably a pretty tightly contested race this year for most of these prizes.
Yeah, that I can definitely say. I mean, okay. You know, I certainly would not be able to, you know, say what any one juror's or group of jurors' decisions were, what people argued for, what they didn't argue for, but I can definitely say very, very strong debate for a lot of categories, very strong competition. And I felt like an unusually high number of really significant watches that were strong competitions for each other in each category.
Awesome.
So, you know, exciting year.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for doing this. And, you know, good thing we could do this little recap, and we'll have a lot more for people soon. Auction coverage, more interviews. Things are going to keep coming. Busy season.
2019, a good year for watches.
That's if we did episode titles like that, that would be the title of this episode. Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thank you all.
Cheers.
Today's episode was recorded at Hodinkee HQ in New York City and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on Monday with a full episode.